So you just want us to introduce ourselves then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm Matt first.
Oh, and then I'll do the little, if it's time to like.
Yeah, I didn't have that problem the last time.
No.
No one went back to that.
Yeah. I think we'll get started. My name is Christine Harden, and I'll be moderating this session, Vision Care in Community-Based Programs. Our first presenter, Norma Boyer, is not going to be presenting today. And so pretty much what I thought we would do, I'd like us to stick with the original schedule because I would hate for someone to expect to see a talk later on come in and then the talk was already over. So Elizabeth Hoppe gave me a brilliant idea. Instead of tap dancing, what we could do is have the speakers introduce themselves now and maybe just give a little elevator blurb about what they're going to talk about, and then they can give their talks. So Dr. Lee Ball.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sure.
And let's see, how do we advance? Right here. This is what we're going to use.
So,
I guess I should
ask that
first.
What we'll do is just say a little something.
Okay,
and then
we'll go down.
And then I'll bring everybody up. And by the time that we do that, you'll be ready to start.
Well, I think this is probably the most difficult thing to do, is to talk about yourself. Just to give you a little background, I'm obviously an optometrist, practicing in Boston, Massachusetts at Joslin Diabetes Center and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. So I split my day. In the mornings, I'm at Joslin. I see primarily patients with diabetes, and I've been doing that for about the last 3 years. And then in the afternoons, I go over to the Beth Israel, where I staff a triage clinic. So basically, I see pretty much all the red eyes and things that are referred down from healthcare associates, which I'll get into the talk in here in just a bit, how the way that I practice and the manner that I practice is pretty much well contained. It's within an academic medical center, and so there are electronic medical records, and there's good ways to communicate our findings amongst ourselves. Say, for instance, a patient walks in and sees their primary care physician with an ocular complaint, and then the PCP, internal medicine, will call down to the eye unit, one floor below them, and say, can you get this patient added in? And so I can look in the computer and I can get an idea of what's going on with the patient before the patient even arrives. And then by the time that I finish, of course, I put my note back into the computer, and the primary care physician can see what the diagnosis and the treatment plan is. But we don't have that luxury in the majority of our healthcare systems. As you well know, most of our patients sometimes travel all over town, if not to many different towns, to receive their care. And that's what I'm going to get in today, is how to develop that team or healthcare approach. I should tell you a little bit more about myself. I'm a 2001 graduate from the University of Houston, and actually had the pleasure of Dr. Bailey being my public health professor. I'm also an undergraduate, was at the University of North Carolina, where I did my baccalaureate in public health. And I sort of stumbled into public health. I was actually a biology major and knew I wanted to go to optometry school, and then just happened to go up with a friend to the School of Public Health one day who was applying. I was like, public health, what's this stuff? Sounds kind of interesting. Applied, got in, and just really opened my eyes and my world to this great profession and how it really wraps its arms around all aspects of healthcare. After that, like I said, I went to the University of Houston, and then after that I had the pleasure of going down to Bascom Palmer for an optometric residency, which then took me to Boston, which I've been for the last 6 years. I also serve on the American Public, excuse me, the Healthy Eyes, Healthy People Committee for the American Optometric Association. I'm the Vice Chair of the National Diabetes Education PPOD work group, which is why I'm here today, and thank you for the opportunity inviting me to speak. And I also serve on the Better Vision Institute, which is a group of optometrists, ophthalmologists, and opticians working together to address some of these issues in our committee, in our ophthalmic world. And lastly, I have the pleasure of working with Niall at the National Institute at the National Eye Health Education Program. So, all right, I guess that's it for me.
All right, great. Okay, and Dr. Jeannie Christine Washington. We're expecting
These guys weren't expecting to have to do this.
Totally unexpected, but I'm Dr. Jeannie Washington. I'm an optometrist. I'm in primary eye care private practice. I have three primary eye care practices in Chicago, in Hyde Park, Oak Park, and downtown Chicago. I graduated from the Illinois College of Optometry in 1993 and recently received a master's in public health from the University of Illinois approximately 2 years ago. Basically, I got into public health from some, at least the interest of public health, from colleagues at Illinois College of Optometry, Dr. Sandra Block and some other people there. And again, what I found out and what you've probably found out is that a lot of people don't even understand or know what public health is all about. I didn't either. However, once I got into it, I did find a niche. And that niche was glaucoma screenings. I found a benefit for it in my community, and as a result have been charged and asked to act as a consultant for other people who are interested in glaucoma in their communities as well. Today I'll be talking about an evidence-based program evaluation that I conducted at one of the local hospitals, and how my public health experience and my experience in screenings allowed me to go over and help them with some things that they were doing there. In terms of other things that I do serve as the chairman of the board for an organization called Service to Seniors. That organization is very well entrenched in public health in terms of bridging the gap in public health disparities by hooking up seniors with younger people to talk about how we can close the gap in some of the public health disparities of chronic diseases and glaucoma that exist. And with that, I guess I'll turn it over to the next person.
Okay, Dr. Janice Eklund. Winters, thank you.
Hi, I'm Janice Winters, and you know what? When I got married, I was convinced that Eklund, I'm going to make it my middle name, it'll make it so easy, and it'll be just J.E. Winters. And it gets me into more trouble because people think it's hyphenated and it's Eklund Winters, but it's not. It's just Winters.
Well, next time you come up.
Yeah, right there. She'll be right on the ball. Well, I feel right at home because we're in the Chicago room, right?
Yeah.
And we're both from Chicago. I practice at ICO. I'm in the primary care and low vision clinics. And I get into public health completely by chance. A community-based program came along a few years back called Fight for Seniors. It was a program by which we sent out a representative to kind of recruit patients from a Chicago Housing Authority senior development for eye exams. So we educated them about the importance of eye examinations, and we provided them with eye care and eyeglasses. And it was through that program that I really got an interest in community-based programs and saw how much power, how difficult they are, first of all, but really what an impact they can have on patients' lives. I was going to mention this later in the talk, but I will do it now because it kind of doesn't go with what I'm talking about later anyhow. One of the end results of Sight for Seniors is we determined that one of the barriers that kept people from seeking eye care was that although they all had Medicare, they didn't understand that Medicare actually covered eye care and, you know, what it covered, what it didn't cover. And I looked around and I couldn't find any good brochures. We had a little bit of leftover money from the program, so I developed the Medicare and Eye Care Benefits brochure. And I'm more than willing to share if anybody would like a copy or is any interest. It's just grant funded, so if you have any interest in it and I give you a copy, just let me know if you ever use it. But, you know, feel free. The program I'm talking about today is the Vision of Hope Health Alliance. That is another grant funded program where we provide eye care to low-income uninsured people. They're referred from partner agencies. I'll talk a little more about that later. Kind of the unique thing about Vision of Hope is it's just not the eye care, but we ask people if they have a primary care provider. If they don't, we provide them referral to a fairly qualified health center where they can get eye care at or medical care at a reasonable cost. And when you look in their literature, and I was here earlier, PCPs have such an impact. So I think getting somebody hooked up with a PCP is key for their general medical care as well as their eye care. To promote Vision of Hope, I developed a video, which the link is going to be on my PowerPoint. So feel free to look at that, and if you have any use for it, use it. Or if you'd like to know more about how we did it, please contact me. Also, I developed a brochure for Vision of Hope to promote the program. And again, I know how difficult these programs are, so if you have any interest in the brochure, doing something similar for any of your programs, please let me know, and I'm more than willing to share. So that's it.
And Mr. Jeff Tott?
Well, I, too, am from Chicago, so
wow.
Definitely the Chicago roots. I'm with Prevent Blindness America. I'm vice president over our communications and marketing functions, as well as our public health, government affairs, and program outreach work. I am neither an optometrist or a public health practitioner by education. My training is in law. I'm an attorney, although don't hold that against me, and I don't practice law. But I've been with Prevent Blindness for about 5 years. My background has been in community health work, primarily working, or previous to vision care, it was working in youth-related issues, substance abuse issues, and youth violence issues. But it's really been, the core has been community planning and working with communities to have an impact on whatever problems they are addressing. Today I'm here to talk about a program that we've done in collaboration with the Wise Woman program out of the Centers for Disease Control, and specifically how that program's been implemented in the state of North Carolina. So I look forward to talking to you more about that here in a few moments.
Okay, well, we're just about there. So does anyone have any, Oh, I didn't even introduce myself. I'm Christine Harden, and I'll be moderating this section today. I'm an optometrist. I teach at the University of Houston College of Optometry, and I am looking to shift gears into a career in studying health services. So if anyone wants to, I'm shopping for programs, and I think it's a really exciting thing. And right now, sorry? Chicago? Chicago's a great place. In fact, my people are from Chicago, so I can even talk like you guys if you want to. Chicago. So, but at any rate, community health is dear to my heart, and I have worked at a number of community health centers. I've worked at a correctional facility. Disparities in healthcare and eye care in particular are something that I deal with all the time. And it's interesting, having worked in a community health center where people are, at least once they walk in the door, they're plugged in, and you can, or at the Veterans Hospital, I worked there for about 4 years. It's difficult to get in sometimes. Once you're in the door, it's a lovely thing to be able to refer to a colleague within the system. Currently at the University of Houston, I have a lot of folks who come in. They get their eye care through Prevent Blindness or another program, and it's very, very difficult to get them hooked up with a healthcare system. So I think community-based care and this kind of research is a wonderful thing. And everyone keeps alluding to the election that's coming up. So who knows? You know, maybe I'm not going to go there. Community health centers were mentioned during the debates, though, and so that was really encouraging. Let's see how we're doing. I think we're doing pretty well. Okay. In that case, Lee Ball, hit it.
Yeah.
Okay, so like I had alluded to a little earlier, coordination of care presents many challenges, as we're aware are well of, and with a variety of settings. But this coordination helps ensure the adherence to the intended treatment plans and to identify disease and drug management problems in a timely manner. So we all, I think we all agree, it's very, very important to have this communication among different providers that are caring for our patients with diabetes. So, and so the right hand sort of knows what the left is doing. But this multidisciplinary team approach is critical to the success in diabetes care and complications prevention. And that's really where the PPOD work group comes in. And what we try to, because oftentimes, as you well know, PPOD providers, pharmacists, podiatrists, optometrists, and dental health providers, dentists and hygienists, are often a primary entry point for patients with type 2 diabetes. Patients will go to their local pharmacy because they're experiencing blurriness in their vision, and the pharmacist may see that they are a little, have some of the risk factors for diabetes, type 2 diabetes, that maybe they're obese or they have a family history, and say, well, you know, have you really considered getting an eye examination? And sometimes patients will come in when those over-the-counter glasses just aren't getting the job done. So, and although we don't make the official diagnosis of diabetes, we certainly see things in our examinations and refer them to the primary care physician or internal medicine physician for an official testing and diagnosis. So the team, the purpose of this lecture is to encourage primary care physician and others, i.e., organizations, payers, community advocates, etc., to establish a multidisciplinary team healthcare approach for treating patients with diabetes. And that's really the goal of working together, which is the primer. Which, thank you very much, Janice, for talking about handouts. I have just a couple of primers here. I have four, if anyone would like to take them, and also one of our medication. Please come up after the lecture. You may have them. I certainly don't want to schlep them back to Boston. And then I'll show you how you can get them as well if you don't want to schlep them back to your home. And you can download them or have one mailed to you. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the pharmacist role. People with diabetes should establish a relationship with their pharmacist, and they often do, who can help them monitor drug regimens, advise how to take medications properly, and to provide other information to help them control their diabetes. Strategies include the use of medications, and this is well within the training and really the purview of the pharmacist. Pharmacists, when they dispense the medications, and especially with the evolution of pharmacy into the PharmD program, they're doing a lot more education with the patient and talking to the patient. In fact, at Beth Israel at the hospital, the pharmacists do the rounds with many of the physicians that they're working on particular cases with. They remind patients the best time to take medications, about potential interactions, also about self-treatments and over-the-counter medications. And I don't know about you, but almost every one of my patients that I see, they come in, they're taking some sort of minerals and oils and vitamins and who knows what. And we really don't know, since these things aren't FDA regulated, is what's on the bottle really in the bottle. And, you know, I was just at the Academy of Optometry meeting last week, and this is actually infiltrating into our profession with AREDS 1 and then soon out to be AREDS 2, the study of the age-related eye disease. We're actually seeing more use of these vitamins and minerals and things for protective factors against macular degeneration. But I have to tell you, I don't feel really comfortable with it and don't know a lot about it, and oftentimes I will call on my pharmacy colleagues to help me with these sticky questions that patients ask me, and I really just don't feel well schooled in. Also, another role of pharmacists is to help patients select and also learn to use their glucose monitors. Additionally, pharmacists can also tell about the latest technology that's available and let the patient know whether their insurance is going to cover this technology or not. It's oftentimes it's frustrating when a patient wants a particular treatment or a particular device, and unfortunately their insurance may not cover it. And the pharmacists can help patients navigate these types of issues. And also certainly with cost control. Pharmacists are excellent and well-schooled at changing over to generic medications and also helping patients to maximize these fleeting healthcare dollars. So what about the podiatrist role, and which is a very important one, as you can see. We know that one of the microvascular complications of diabetes is this peripheral neuropathy. And as patients with diabetes begin to lose the sensation in their hands and their feet, it changes the way, because of the lack of the appropriate receptive feedback, that they walk. And so it can change their biomechanics, which can give them pressure points and stress and wear areas on different parts of their feet. Puts them at risk for developing calluses and corns and bunions and even ulcers, as we can see on the great toe here. We also know that because of peripheral vascular disease that all of our patients with diabetes suffer from, that this decreases their wound healing time and can lead to increased occurrences of ulceration and amputations, amputations of the toe, the foot, of the leg, and even death in bad case scenarios and bad infections and poor wound healing. So a comprehensive foot examination for abnormalities includes the evaluation of pulses, sensation, foot biomechanics, and nails to determine the patient's category of risk for developing foot complications. And forgive me for reading to you. Normally my colleague, Dr. Torres, the podiatrist, does this section. So, persons with diabetes who are at high risk have one or more of the following characteristics. Loss of protective sensation, like we've talked about, from peripheral neuropathy. Absent pedal pulses, foot deformities. I think you've probably seen patients come in and their feet just won't fit in their shoes because they get this Charcot foot where their foot begins to atrophy and it makes it really difficult for them to walk, and they can stumble and fall, and it's really quite disheartening when you see patients suffering this type of morbidity. And history of foot ulcers and prior amputations. Let's talk about eye health, something that many of us are well versed in. And how many people here are optometrists or ophthalmologists, eye care providers? All right. And how many people are primary care physicians or internal medicine? Just so I kind of know the audience. No? Pardon?
Blindness rehab.
Great. Any CDEs, certified diabetes educators, dietitians, nurse practitioners? Okay. So blindness, as we know, is one of the leading causes of new-onset blindness in the working-age adults. There's somewhere between 12 and 24,000 cases of blindness each year, and people with diabetes can maintain optimal vision and health by having an annual dilated eye exam. We also know from landmark studies like the Diabetic Retinopathy Study and the ETDRS, Early Treatment of Diabetic Retinopathy Study, that once retinopathy is found, and if it's treated appropriately, that in about 50% of the cases, we can prevent our patients from having significant vision loss down to the level of about 5/200. So we know vision loss occurs from vitreous hemorrhage, when the blood actually blocks the light from reaching the photoreceptors, and it begins to get scar and fibrosis and get a traction retinal detachment, and also from diabetic macular edema, which can be devastating to the central vision. Once the vascular starts to break down, you lose the pericytes on the endothelium, and you start getting the outpouching and the microaneurysms, and the vessels start to leak this proteinaceous blood, and the fluid collects in the macula, and if it stays there long enough, as you know, it'll scar, and they'll have permanent vision loss. That's what we want to try to avoid. What are other complications of diabetes? And I think this is sometimes something that's often overlooked. Most of the time we just wrap our hands around retinopathy, and a lot of times that's what the primary care physician, that's what's on his or her radar screen. But there are also other things that we as eye care providers are well aware of for our patients with diabetes, and that's the fluctuating vision. The lens, as we know, is a living piece of tissue. In fact, post-mortem, it'll live a couple of days, just like our nails and our skin does. And with the sorbitol pathway, with the deposition into the lens, we can get imbibed of fluid and it swells, and we can get this refractive shift, a myopic shift, which will sometimes drive these undiagnosed undiagnosed type 2 patients into our offices. So there again, the eye care provider is an entryway or portal for these patients with diabetes into the healthcare system. Cataracts, as we know, the lens continues to age just like our skin does, and because of this same metabolism, the lens ages much more quickly. It's not uncommon for me to see a patient in their third decade being a cataract candidate at the Joslin. Because of ischemia, again, to the nerves that control the muscles of the eye, we can have patients that have double vision, and all this will generally resolve in 3 to 6 months. It can certainly decrease quality of life, make driving and ambulating quite difficult, and that's where we can come in and help them in these regards, even if something just as simple as patching an eye. Corneal abrasions, ulcers, and dry eye. Because of this neuropathy of the cornea, it loses sensation feedback to the lacrimal gland, so the eye stops producing tears, as we well know, which can lead to breakdown in the epithelium, ulcerization, and entry roads for bacterial and fungal infections. And lastly, glaucoma. A lot of you are probably aware or familiar with the OAT study, the ocular hypertension treatment trial, which says that diabetes is actually protective for glaucoma. But if you really look at the way this study was set up, and this is why it's really important, I think it's a good reminder of why we have to not only just read the summaries of studies, we have to read the way they're designed, is that all of their patients who had diabetes, if any of them had retinopathy, they excluded them from the study. So none of the patients in OATS had diabetic retinopathy. And so we're kind of talking about apples and oranges here. I think all of us will agree that because of ischemia to the optic nerve head, and especially because of vascular endothelial growth factors leaching through the vitreous into the anterior segment of the eye, that actually diabetes is a risk factor for glaucoma. That's why it's so important to make sure that every patient with diabetes has a careful biomicroscopy exam of the iris and also gonioscopy to look for signs of neovascularization. Because as we well know, neovascular glaucoma is very, very difficult to treat, and not only will you end up with a blind eye, but a very painful eye. Oral health and diabetes. Diabetes can lead to changes in the oral cavity. Of particular concern to dentists and dental hygienists are the effects on the health of the gingiva and periodontal tissues. Poor glycemic control is associated with gingivitis and more severe periodontal disease. And this is what's been really great for me and having the opportunity to work and learn at the National Diabetes Education Program. Not only have I learned more about our profession, as I've had to learn how to articulate what we do and our expertise in a venue that other professionals who are not trained in eye health can understand. But at the same time, my colleagues, my dental colleagues, dental hygienists, pharmacists, and podiatrists are doing the same thing to me. And so I was really amazed to find out the link between gingivitis and increased inflammation in the body, elevated chronic inflammation C-reactive proteins, which leads to this uncontrolled glycemia. Individuals with diabetes may notice a fruity acetone breath, frequent dry mouth, just like they can get dry eye, changes in their saliva thickness, and this I didn't know, there's bacteria in our saliva which is protective for decay of our teeth. That's why, if you ever see patients with diabetes, usually their teeth start discoloring and they usually have little nicks in them and notches and things like that. It's something I really never paid attention to until I started working on this work group. And now when I see my patients come in at the JAWS and I notice and I look at them as a patient, a total patient, and not just a set of eyeballs. And I know that all of the professors have always told us that, but sometimes it just doesn't click when you're a student. Unfortunately, caring for the mouth is often overlooked when trying to control other problems associated with diabetes. And however, good glycemic control can prevent many of these problems. There's actually a study, some information out in Grand Rounds. This was May 2006. The impact of periodontists on metabolic control and risk for diabetic complications. And this is a study that George Taylor at the University of Michigan was involved in. And George serves with us on the Peapod work group as a content expert. And he's really spearheading these data. So just to give you a little bit about this study, about people with diabetes and severe periodontal disease have about a 6 times increased risk of poor glycemic control. Again, the theory is that the chronic inflammation in the gums creates an elevated or hyperactivity state in the body, an inflammatory state. 82% of these individuals in the study had one or more macrovascular complications, cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular attacks, versus 21%. The death rate due to CVD was a little over 2 times higher, and the death rate from nephropathy, which is a microvascular complication, was almost 10 times greater, about 8.5. So you got to think, if there's something going on in the kidney, it's got to be going on in the retina as well. So people with poorly controlled diabetes have more periodontal disease than people who were well controlled. And in a study of Pima Indians, the improved periodontal disease correlated with better glucose control. So kind of in the nutshell, it seems pretty intuitive to us that effective interventions promote multiple good outcomes. But now we have some evidence-based studies to back up our hunches. And how am I doing on time? Because this is like an hour talk I had to try to crunch down. 6 minutes. I got to go. So why does diabetes continue to command our attention? That's because we got about 4,100 new cases of diabetes a year, leading to 810 deaths, 230 amputations, 120 renal failures, and about 55 cases of preventable blindness. This cost us about $132 billion in 2002 dollars, and actually the 2007 data came out recently, and it's more like $174 billion. So it's not going down, it's actually going up, which is no surprise. We've got great studies that show the CCT, the Kumamoto, and UKPDS, that tight glycemic control reduces the microvascular complications. It hinted at some of the macrovascular complications. Some of you may be aware of the latest studies out, the Accord and all these things. There's a lot of controversy going on right there. The jury is still out about patients who were very intensely controlled actually expired. I don't think any of us can say at this point, although there's studies that these data are being looked at, I think we can still say safely that you want to try to keep your blood sugar as well maintained and well controlled as possible. And of course, we'll have more better analysis of these new studies within the next few months. So how can we harness our efforts? And this is where the NDEP comes in. Diabetes is, and these are the four messages. I'm not going to read to you these slides, but these are the four main programs of the NDEP, National Diabetes Education Program. The goal is basically of the PPOD is to utilize the four providers to make sure that we work synergistically with each other and also and with the primary care physician, nurse practitioners, etc. I'm just going to blast through some of this stuff. This is what the primer of the goals are. We basically, it's a cross-training document. It's not a be-all, end-all on diabetes eye care, foot care, oral health care, but it's a starting point. It's a way to get us all talking and on the same page. This is what the primer looks like. Like I said, I have four copies up here. This is our medication supplement. And that's just kind of a general layout. A lot of people really like this because it's comprehensive, and it's actually updated. It's up to date by our pharmacy team. They did a really good job with this. This is actually something that I use every day in my practice, and this is the PPOD poster, where we took our main messages. And I use this by putting this on the back of my examination door. And then when I'm finished examining my patients with diabetes, I just kind of roll over, and provided I've done an accurate job refracting them, I can just easily go down, bam, 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 and I can make sure I hit all these common themes. Control your ABCs, your A1C, your blood pressure, your cholesterol. You had your eye exam today, I need to see you back in a year, or if I need to see them back sooner, of course I tell them that. But make sure, don't forget about having your foot care, your oral health care, and also you might want to just go over how to take that metformin again with your pharmacist. If you miss a dose one day, what do you do on the next day? Do you double up? I mean, these are pretty common questions that we often hear. We have it in the Spanish version. And lastly, I just want to take 2 minutes and leave you with this. A lot of the stuff that we've talked about, you're probably well aware of. But what you may not be aware of is that at least 54 million Americans age 20 or older have prediabetes. And prediabetes is that they have impaired fasting glucose or an impaired glucose tolerance test. And this puts them at a risk for developing type 2 diabetes. And this is really where the DPP came out, which was a lifestyle intervention study. And the aim here was to say, if you can reduce your fat and caloric intake, and if you can by increasing your physical activity for 150 minutes per week, I mean, that's only 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And it's not talking about running a marathon or lifting weights. I mean, it's just talking about walking. Even some people, like in the Hispanic Latino community, we found that dancing is a great source of activity. I mean, if any of you have ever merengued or salsa for 30 minutes and keeping up with the music, I mean, that you can actually break a sweat. So there are different ways to approach it, but the idea is to get people active. And the study shows that if you can lose and maintain this loss of 5% to 7% of your body weight, it reduces the risk of diabetes, the conversion from prediabetes to type 2 diabetes, by 58%. What medication do we have that has this type of impact? There was an arm of the study that looked at metformin, and that was only half. I mean, that was only around 30% effective. So this is a small step can have a really big reward. And in patients, the power of this study was it worked in all ethnicities and all ages. They really did a good job of including all the at-risk populations. And among people 60 and older, it was even higher. It was a 71% reduction in the conversion from impaired glucose tolerance or prediabetes to type 2 diabetes. So, and that's what this chart is supposed to show us here. We know that patients, once they start developing complications, they're going to lead to disability and death, morbidity and mortality. So our goal as primary care providers, as public health providers, is to get people going from here and here back to the normal. And that's what the DPP tells us it can do, just by losing 5 to 7% of our body weight. Not much, you know, what, 10 pounds if you're a 200-pound individual. So I want to leave you with this, my friends, and it's the challenge. And I always like to end with this because of all the statistics that I've seen over the last 5 years, You know, this is the one that really reaches out and tugs at my heartstrings the most. As many of my contemporaries are having children, and as many of you, or maybe even some of you, you guys are a young-looking group, but sometimes I speak to people who actually have grandchildren who are being born in 2002. One in three will have diabetes at some point in their lifetime if something doesn't change. And this is because of the epidemic of obesity and diabetes in our country. So my challenge to you and my plea to you is to be part of that something. And this is what PPOP providers do. We need to work together because this really is an epidemic. And the only way we're gonna get through this is by working together, communicating with each other. Where to go for information? NDEP.nih.gov. You can actually read the primer and do an online test, and you can actually get some CE for it. All right, thank you so very much. And I know I ran a little over.
Thank you, Lee. That was really exciting. And, you know, when I think about the diabetes prevention trial, you know, we're always emphasizing preventive measures. If you have poor dentition, it's very difficult to eat the fruits and vegetables that are recommended. If you have poor foot care, it's very difficult to exercise. So I think that preventing those morbidities is really important. Maybe questions towards the end? We've got one question. Yeah.
Sure, that's a great question. As you know, that's a